Good morning, good morning. I'm Dave Mazza.
And I'm Joanne Bowman.
And you're listening to Voices from the Edge. Last month, 14 Oregonians died as a result of 5 murder-suicide and 1 attempted murder-suicide incident. Men took guns, killed their spouses, ex-spouses, and in some cases, some of their children. Why is this happening? We want to spend some time this morning talking about that. The mainstream press's coverage is largely focusing on the horror of the incident, and indeed they are truly horrible, but there's not much discussion about the underlying causes. Why are we seeing this sudden uptick? Is it part of a growing trend? And what are the deeper reasons for this sort of violence, this sort of family annihilation to be taking place? So joining us this morning to help us with this conversation is Jennifer Warren, who is a counselor with the Men's Resource Center and Women's Counseling Center, an organization that has been working on domestic violence issues, well, since the mid-70s, I believe. So they've been working on it quite some time. And we want to thank Jennifer for coming in this morning to join us in this conversation.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And as always, we want you to join us in the conversation and give us your thoughts about this very important issue by giving us a call at 503-231-8187. Jennifer, why don't we start first? I mean, the question, I guess, to ask initially is this some sort of statistical glitch that we've got this sudden rash of incidents, or is it part of a trend? What's the perspective?
Well, I think that most of us in the domestic violence intervention community feel like it's a coincidental that there's it just happens to be happening at the same time now, and I think that that makes a lot of sense.
And do you think the economic situation that we find ourselves in? I mean, when this first started, my first thought was, is it because people are in such desperate situations that we're all of a sudden seeing so many more of these incidents?
Yeah, that was my first thought too. As the body toll started to rise, and it's definitely one of the factors, because a very large percentage of the men that come into our agency seeking help for domestic violence are unemployed or underemployed, and that is a huge blow to a man's ego, which in turn affects how he feels about himself, can contribute to depression, and impacts the family as a whole.
Now, we're talking about oftentimes men who are unemployed. Are we looking at across the board in terms of class? Are we seeing primarily people from the lower end of the economic spectrum, or are these people who have been in a more secure position within society and now suddenly seeing the bottom falling out?
I'm seeing it all across the board as far as class goes. I'm seeing executives losing their jobs as well as construction workers.
And I think the other question is we should state early that domestic violence can work both ways, right? Women can commit domestic violence just like men can commit domestic violence.
Yes.
And so what is the based on your experience, kind of, we know that the majority of the cases we hear about is actually men that are involved in the violence, right? That
Correct.
Leads to death.
Yes.
But based on your work, is treatment different for men than it is for women who actually are the perpetrators of domestic violence?
Yeah, actually, it is different. I've been doing a women's group pretty consistently now for 5.5 years, and I'd say the majority of the women in the domestic violence intervention group, so these are women who have been arrested for domestic violence, are what we would call secondary perpetrators.
Mm. What do you mean by that?
That means that their partner is the primary perpetrator, and they at some point start either fighting back or started mimicking some of the same behaviors. What we do know statistically is that it is much more likely that a female is going to be hurt or killed during a domestic violence altercation than a male. And from what a lot of the men in my group say when they describe their partners attacking them, they'll say she came at me or she hit me or whatever however they describe it, then they often don't consider it. It's not part of a pattern of fear and intimidation for them. And sometimes they even like laugh it off and they say, what's she going to do to me? Mm-hmm. And she may be hitting at him, but not doing any actual harm. Mm-hmm. And then he can turn around and with his greater strength and socialized training to be violent can do a lot more harm much more quickly. So a lot of the women I have in the women's domestic violence intervention group have been victims themselves and have been very victimized. I mean, I'm talking a lot of dental work, a lot of broken bones. So it's not unusual.
We tend to focus in the media on the most severe cases, you know, obviously the ones like the we opened the show with, in which, you know, people are committing murders with weapons. But I mean, my understanding is that actually we've seen a bit of a decline in those more extreme types of domestic violence-related homicides, suicides over the last few years. But how do they fit in terms of the bigger picture? What sort of numbers are we looking at overall for domestic violence in Oregon, and has that been going down, up, staying steady?
You know, I'm not really sure whether from, I mean, I know that I've read that it's been going down and arrests have gone down in some areas, but it really, it depends on what the social system is set up in that county, you know, what the beliefs are about domestic violence, and, you know, different officers treat it differently depending on their own experiences and how much training they've had. But from my experience, then we hear a lot about the big things. We hear a lot about the murder suicides, but and that is part of our denial system, because that way a lot of people who are committing domestic violence on what they consider a lower level, such as verbal abuse, psychological abuse, can kind of say, well, that's not me. You know, I'm not that kind of guy. I would never go that far. I would never do that. But the reality is that the impact that verbal and psychological abuse has on the victims is often far more significant than the physical violence in the long term.
And so in Oregon, what is the law? If law enforcement is called out because of a domestic violence situation, does the law in Oregon require someone to be arrested?
No, it does not require that someone is arrested. However, if they have evidence that there has been an assault, there's, depending on the stories, witnesses, if there's, you know, who is, I guess, damaged more, if there's marks, then in those instances, then someone would be arrested. And that varies, you know, depending on how the officers, the skill of the officer, how they see the situation. And I've worked a lot through Washington County, and, you know, they do a lot of training with their officers in Washington County, and they do here too in Multnomah County. I mean, I'd say Oregon is one of the leaders in the nation in dealing with domestic violence, and this tri-county area is a big part of that. So I'd say that the skills are getting better all the time with the officers that go out.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Voices from the Edge, and Joanne and I are talking this morning with Jennifer Warren, who is a social worker with the Men's Resource Center and Women's Counseling Center here in Portland. She specializes in particular on working on with victims or with people who have been in the criminal justice system as a result of domestic violence. And we're talking today to try to get some idea of what's happening here in Oregon in terms of domestic violence, particularly in light of last month's wave of extremely violent incidents. If you want to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187.
I know one of the things that whenever one of these kind of incidents makes the paper, you know, there are a couple of responses that we see in the media. One is, well, you know, they were such a nice family. We didn't see any evidence of any kind of problems. What are things that community members should be looking out for before these incidents end up in a situation where someone is killed or seriously injured?
That's a really good question, because a lot of people who are in domestic violence relationships are in denial themselves that they're in a domestic violence relationship. And sometimes someone from the outside can recognize it more clearly because they're not in the middle of it. They may witness, you know, one partner cutting down the other partner, making comments, manipulating, lying. Those are all signs that something's not going well in the relationship. But a lot of times there's a lot of people that hide what they're experiencing because of the shame attached to it, as well as perpetrators that hide it because of the shame attached to it and not wanting to be labeled as one of the biggest fears the clients have is being labeled as a wife beater. And and so that keeps a lot of people from seeking out help, I believe. And it keeps a lot of women who are being abused from really recognizing that that's what's going on in their relationship, because maybe it only happens when he drinks. Maybe it only happens when she's done something that she feels guilty for. Maybe, it, you know, there's a lot of ways that we justify and rationalize to ourselves why things happen.
And so normally if somebody is exhibiting controlling behavior, right, mm-hmm. they're keeping you from your family, you're changing your entire routine to accommodate right. a relationship. I mean, there are some very specific warning signs.
Absolutely,
right?
Like isolation. That's mm-hmm. one of the first things that happens in a relationship is the in an abusive relationship is that, for instance, in a heterosexual relationship when the male is the abuser, mm-hmm. then she will start losing friends and family. He will sometimes purposefully isolate her, and sometimes the friends are the first to notice that something's going on. She's crying all the time. She's, you know, maybe she's coming to work with bruises, but mostly there's the emotional toll, and they often will sort of drop out of the picture because they feel like they can't talk sense into her, or it's just painful for them to watch. Mm-hmm.
And so what advice would you give people that are kind of noticing this kind of behavior taking place? What as a counselor, just kind of how would you help them work through that kind of situation? What are the right questions to ask, I guess, is the question I'm asking.
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, it's important to remain a friend uh-huh. and to really be there and to let yourself be known that I'm here for you, I'm supporting you, regardless of what choices you make. Because uh-huh. a lot of times then victims are afraid to go to their friends, afraid to go to their families, because the first response is, well, you have to leave.
Right.
And they don't want to do that, or they want to come up with other solutions, or they're afraid. And so that may contribute to their own depression, their own choice to isolate themselves is because of they're already feeling powerless in the relationship. And then when friends and family start telling them what they need to do, mm-hmm. then that just compounds their sense of powerlessness.
And I know in communities of color, it's exacerbated based on engaging law enforcement in the activity.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, there was a stigma, especially in the African-American Latino community, because, you know, we already know that men of color are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. And so there was no desire to actually make that worse. Up until just very recently, there really weren't responses to how do you do counseling as a couple to try to resolve some of these kind of conflicts. It was either you prosecute and then the court mandates treatment or nothing, right? It was an either-or kind of situation
right.
until fairly recently, just in the last couple of years, have there become some additional models about how you can get counseling as a family.
Yeah, and that is something that we feel really strongly should be happening after he's already doing treatment mm-hmm. and has already shown accountability in group mm-hmm. and maybe even completed a program, because mm-hmm. couples counseling can be really misleading when there's a power disparity between the couples. Mm-hmm. And unless the counselor is highly skilled in recognizing domestic violence, mm-hmm. Then the couple can come in, sit down, everything can seem fine, and she could actually be terrified to say half of what's going on.
Uh-huh.
So we don't recommend couples counseling while the abuse is going on. And really, we would focus on him getting treatment or him attending a program for domestic violence intervention. Ideally, she's getting some sort of counseling, some sort of survivor support, mm-hmm. and then eventually them coming back together into couples counseling after he's learned to be accountable and she feels safer. Mm. Otherwise, it could create a more dangerous situation for her, sort of sharing what is going on behind the doors, closed doors.
Well, you're listening to Voices from the Edge, and this morning Joanne and I are talking with Jennifer Warren, who is a counselor with the Men's Resource Center and Women's Counseling Center here in Portland. She works with people who have been involved in domestic violence, including those who have been entered into the criminal justice system as a result of being perpetrators of domestic violence. And we're talking this morning in particular about what the situation is here in Oregon, particularly in light of last month's string of highly visible and highly violent murder-suicides that were domestic violence related, And what's the underlying causes? How do we deal with it? How do we move forward? We'd like to hear from you. Get your ideas on this, your thoughts and feelings. Give us a call at 503-231-8187. Are we seeing any generational differences in dealing with this issue? I mean, you know, it's still very much an in-the-closet issue in many communities and many areas. There has certainly been a much more discussion of it in terms of popular culture, you know, mm-hmm. and education in the last 30 years. Does any of that seem to be having an impact? Do, you know, are younger people who are becoming involved in this, you know, is there any difference that way, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, I think there's a lot more awareness for the younger generation. They're more likely to recognize something as domestic violence. They're doing more education in school-based programs, talking, just sort of educating. So there's differences there. I think that there's also differences in women fighting back more. I don't know if that statistically fleshes out or not, but it seems to me that there is more of an increase of, okay, I know you're not supposed to be able to treat me this way, but then her reaction, it looks like she's crazy because she's emotional, she's upset, and so it can be pretty overwhelming for everyone involved. But I, you know, we're talking about it more, and people are changing their parenting styles a little bit. I think that that is something that's going to be a big influence in the future on domestic violence.
What do you mean by that, and that they're changing their parenting style and how that affects domestic violence?
Well, for instance, corporal punishment has always been a huge part of our culture. And what that does is it teaches children from a very early age that violence is acceptable and that love and violence are acceptable together. So when you have parents that say, I love you, mm-hmm. but then they say, and I'm hitting you, and it's for your own good, mm-hmm. then you're training a child for a future of violence. And that's something that's very hard for our culture to hear. They don't want to give up this any more than they want to give up red meat. And it's difficult.
Yeah.
Wow. Talking about the children, what is the impact? What happens to kids who grow up in homes where domestic violence is taking place?
So many things happen. It's really horrible for the children. Not only witnessing domestic violence creates anxiety, depression. It can cause sleeping issues, but they become hyper vigilant and aware of their surroundings. It's like being raised in a war zone. Mm. And so they may always be anxious, you know, they may know just by the way that, you know, dad's shoes feel walking into the house and sound walking the house, whether or not it's going to be a good night or a bad night. Mm-hmm. It affects their school performance, and it affects their desire to be connected as a family unit. You know, if mom is worn out because she's being verbally abused, psychologically abused, broken down, you know, then the child isn't getting the amount of attention that they need from their parents. And if their parents are always involved with each other, they're not getting what they need, but they are getting a lot of role modeling for how to resolve conflict. And if that means that one person gets hit, that's what they're learning. Mm-hmm. If both people get hit.
Want to pick that up again, but first we're going to go to the phone lines because we have some callers. Our listeners have finished their cups of coffee this morning and are finally getting to their phones. And if you want to join us in this conversation with Jennifer Warren of the Men's Resource Center and Women's Counseling Center about domestic violence in general in Oregon, as well as the more dramatic incidents that occurred last month, give us a call at 503-231-8187. So let's go to our first caller on the line. Good morning, caller.
Yes, hello. I have a couple of questions. The first one is the domestic violence clients in the shelters, whatever. Is one of the first steps of help they get, do they get housing with the housing authority? And also the second question, your clients or domestic violence clients, whether male or female, have any of them recently been in the military or been in Iraq? Thank you.
Good question.
Well, I can address the second part first. And we actually do have a combat veterans program at the Men's Resource Center that meets in Oregon City. We just have one group at this point, but those are for that. It's very different for me doing an intake with a man who has recently returned from the Middle East. versus someone who has never been in the military. There is it. It changes them so dramatically, and it's important that they are handled differently because they have seen unspeakable violence themselves and have had to shut themselves down. And so it's very easy for them to be disconnected, shut down, no empathy for the people that they previously loved. And they still may love them, but they know that they're not returning as the same person that they left as. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've heard consistently from the I just happen to have just done intakes with males who have returned from the combat. But they say, I'm not the person I was when I left. I'm a completely different person. And I want to get back to who I was going to be. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the violence is pretty significant that can come out of them, too, because it doesn't take much to kill someone when you've already killed so many other people.
Any indication that the military, as they are, well, while this person is serving or are on their way of being processed out, the military is providing any support around this, or are these guys kind of just
what I'm
men and women, I should make
right.
clear?
What I'm hearing is that there's not a lot of support. There's a lot of struggle, even being, I've had men say that they had to go to outside sources to give them a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. And so I don't think that they're getting their needs met. I think, you know, there's a large number of domestic violence-related shootings and murder-suicides from military as they're coming back and rejoining their families. So it's not being adequately addressed, but it is being addressed to some degree. And, you know, we're working with the VA to try to get people the services they need.
And actually, in the military, it's very I don't think it's helpful to someone's career if they're a career military person to acknowledge they need some
Absolutely.
Psychological
mm-hmm.
help, right?
Absolutely.
And so the stigma that is really increased if mm-hmm. you are a member of the military that have a plan for a career.
Yeah, and
right?
The indication is that even applies to the efforts by the military to provide counseling services right, you know, behind the front lines.
That's right.
I mean, the people are there to treat
right.
the soldiers, but
that's right.
Well, we're going to go back to the phone lines because they're starting to stack up calls here. And if you want to join us in our conversation with Jennifer Warren about domestic violence, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Let's go to our next caller. We have Ron on the line. Good morning, Ron.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question for your guest. Suppose you're acquainted with someone who you think may be in an abusive relationship. What are the steps, or is there, you know, a pattern or phases that a woman might go through before she finally says, you know, something needs to be done here?
Good question.
Yes, and there's a lot, and it kind of matters, too, whether your friend is the perpetrator or the victim as well, because as a man, you have a great amount of power to talk to another man and to say, listen, I see what's going on here, and I don't like it. And that's the thing, is men tend not to call other men out on their behaviors. And so joining, you know, anyone can be a social justice advocate just by starting to pay attention and reaching out and saying, you know, I know things aren't right there. I'd really like to open myself to talking to you about that. So, and what's going on. But, you know, increased drug and alcohol use on the part of the victim, depression, anxiety, missing work, you know, sadness, children not getting their needs met, more abuse towards children. These are all signs of someone who's being victimized.
Right. But I guess maybe I didn't ask very clearly. I was curious about the victim themselves. At what point do they actually turn that corner and go seek help? Is there a way to help them get to that point?
Yeah. You can be supportive of them. You could say, I'm going to be your friend no matter what. The majority of women in these situations would do just about anything to stay out of a shelter. And since there's not a lot of room in the shelters, then that makes a lot of, you know, that's not normally where one would end up anyway. If you have a place that you can offer for them to stay while getting on their feet, then that is always a positive thing. But it's important to recognize that this is a very shameful topic for the victims to discuss. They don't want anyone to know. And so they're going to do, they've already built up a lot of defenses in themselves to to recognizing that it's a dangerous situation. And so it may take, you know, it may take, who knows what it will take to turn a corner for someone. It's very different for every situation.
Okay.
But, you know, sometimes confrontation can be helpful, but sometimes that's exactly what that person is going to need to drive them right back into the arms of their partner. So it's who is abusive towards them. So it's there's no perfect answer for this.
Thank you, Ron, for your questions.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to the next caller because they're, again, lining up. Well, that's not one, but let's go to our next caller. Good morning, caller. You're on the air. We'll just keep working that dial until we get somebody here. Good morning, caller. You're on the air. Well, we seem to be having a little bit of a difficulty here with our phone line, but we'll...
With our phone, yeah. Some mornings are like that. But, Jennifer, one of the questions that I still have is, you're a neighbor, right? And you are hearing sounds that sound pretty violent by your neighbors. And, you know, you don't really know them well, right?
Right.
So as you're going through this process, do you think, you know, do I call the police? Do I go knock on the door? What advice would you give people who, you know, this isn't a family member, but this is someone that lives close to you and you're hearing signs that make you believe there's some violence that's taking place?
I would say call the police. Mm. I have personally intervened in an incident with my neighbors when they were having a domestic violence situation.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't recommend that for the average person.
Mm-hmm.
I've got some mediation skills.
Mm-hmm.
I have self-defense skills.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I didn't know my neighbors very well, I felt compelled to go over and say, listen, I'm going to mm-hmm. call the police if you don't stop this. It was happening outside in the mm-hmm. front yard. And it was when he started making comments that the children could hear
uh-huh.
about never wanting the children that I was over there, even
right.
though it was like 1:30 in the morning.
Right.
And
common sense tells you, you don't, that's not the place
right.
you want to put yourself, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Common
right.
sense.
Yeah, right,
that
right.
doesn't mean that I always follow my own common sense,
right,
but,
right.
You know, I felt comfortable enough going over and saying, listen, I don't want to have to call the police. What can we do? You know, and he was trying to get her to leave and she had recently moved out and he's denying her access to the children and it had become physical and I was able to talk down the situation, but I wouldn't recommend that for most people. I
mm-hmm.
think that oftentimes then if two people are fighting and then a third party comes in, then the two of them will join together to
right.
turn against the third party,
right.
which is why this is so dangerous for the police
mm-hmm.
to come into. But, contacting the police is the number one thing that people should do because at the very least, the police dropping by and checking in on that family
mm.
is going to get something on the record. And it may be the more calls that this person has to that home, the more likely that there is something done and a recognition that there's a real problem.
Well, Jennifer, I have to go back to an earlier statement that I made in communities of color. The calling the police is like not the first instinct that people would have.
Mm-hmm.
We've certainly had situations where the police was called to try to de-escalate a situation, and actually the police being called made the situation worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people go through that in their mind when they're trying to figure out, you know, what's the most appropriate thing to do in these kind of situations. And so I guess I just have to question that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I would think that some communities, the first instinct would not be to call the police, right?
You
know, maybe the instinct would be to knock on the door and threaten to call the police, but not actually call the police.
That may be true. Mm-hmm. However, I live in a neighborhood that has a lot of immigrants,
mm-hmm.
and I've noticed they don't call the police
mm-hmm.
very often either.
Right.
So there's
right.
so what tends to happen is nothing gets done. No one reports anything. And, you know, if there's always the alternative of approaching them when the violence is not going on. But
mm-hmm.
what if it's too late
mm-hmm.
at that point?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very difficult thing because we want to be very supportive of the people that are hurting in
That's
our
right.
lives.
Right.
But I can understand why people are afraid to call the police.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if that person is arrested for domestic violence, then it's not like they pick him up and take him away for the night, have him sleep it off, and then he's fine the next day. I mean, it's an ongoing issue, and often things become a lot worse
That's
after
right.
an arrest
That's right.
If there's a lot of anger on his part and blaming.
And of course, we know that when once a person decides to leave a situation, is when the violence escalates, right? That's when the potential for severe violence. So you could be with someone who's exhibiting controlling behavior. They could be verbally abusive. But then once the decision is made to actually leave that situation, which is what we have experienced over the last month, is that once that decision has been made to leave, that's when there's a there seems to be an escalation in the violent activity. And so what advice would you give to someone who, you know, knows that they're living in a situation that they don't want to continue to live in, know they have to make changes? So how do people prepare themselves to actually get out of that situation alive?
Well, it takes preparation and planning. And there's the Clackamas County Victim Services. There's all the counties have different victim service centers. It'd be a good idea to go in and talk with a victim's advocate about your options around, restraining orders, stalking orders. Mm-hmm. And also they can do safety planning with you, be able to help you sort of figure out what are your options. Having things like copies of important papers, mm-hmm. squirreling away as much money as you can, keeping a bag somewhere safe. Mm-hmm. I know there are organizations that give out free cell phones mm-hmm. to people who are victims of domestic violence because often their phone is taken away during a situation, and so they refurbish old phones so that someone can call 911.
Wonderful. And there are some helplines that people can call.
There are the Women's Crisis mm-hmm. Line. I would highly recommend that. Getting involved in victims' recovery programs, if you're not yet ready to take that next step, then that might be a way just to kind of figure out, am I really in a domestic violence situation? Because the denial, the rationalizations, that's not that bad. Mm-hmm. You know, when you hear about murder suicides, then you're much less likely to consider the relationship you're in to be that abusive. You know, well, he shoves me every now and then, or he's restrained me, but it's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, he's called me names, but he only does that when he's been drinking. Or, you know, I've heard so many things. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that these things tend to get worse and not better. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to get someone to leave the person they love, because that's really, I think, the number one reason that they tend to stay is because they love him. They think he will change. He promises to change. He may be the father of her children, and she wants to have a family. And it's very hard to survive in these economic times as a family, let alone as a single mother.
Well, you're listening to Voices from the Edge, and we're talking this morning with Jennifer Warren of the Men's Resource Center and Women's Counseling Center, and we're talking about domestic violence in general here in Oregon, and particularly in light of last month's series of tragedies involving murder-suicides that were domestic violence-related. And if you want to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Before I go back to the phone line, however, I want to remind you why you need to keep that dial tuned to 90.7 FM, because at 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, on A Deeper Look, hear an interview with Franz de Waal, author of The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, you'll hear the keynote speech by Ali Abu-Nimah at last week's conference on boycott sanctions and divestment at Hampshire College. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Ed Goldberg speaks with Stuart Archer Cohen, author of The Army of the Republic, a novel of resistance to a repressive government in near-future America. Repressive government in near-future America. Imagine. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures welcomes animation director Daryl Van Sitters, author of the new book Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, The Making of the First Animated Christmas. All that coming up on KBOO. Well, we're going to go back to the phone lines because we have some callers who've been waiting. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Good morning, David. Thank you for taking my call. And hi, Joanne.
Hello.
And good morning, Ms. Warren.
Good morning.
A multitude of items that come to mind. Among them, of course, is the easy access to handguns. But that's probably another complete tangential idea, but closely related. But the question I had Ms. Warren especially, is as to psychological makeup. You remember that this recent spate here in our corner of the world occurred almost directly after what happened at Fort Hood. And is there a psychological makeup of a particular man, in these cases all these men who took the lives of their loved one and their own life, is there a particular psychological makeup that we can identify that says this is leading to a suicidal kind of thing, the self-esteem issues, whatnot? Can we separate that out from, or is every domestic violence incident going to become a suicide murder, a murder-suicide? Is there a way to catch it, to find it, to identify it in some kind of makeup, mentality makeup, or psychological profile? And how does the suicidal, is it at all separated from the other, and is there a way to identify it? And for God's sake, let's get guns out of the hands of these nuts. I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, okay. So let me see. Well, I would say that not every domestic violence incident or relationship is going to end up in murder, because there are millions of people walking around that have never been arrested that have perpetrated domestic violence and would never go to that extreme. I think depression is a key factor to be looking at. And going back to the question earlier too about what you can do to support someone, that's something you can do is that men don't tend to get help for depression the way that women do. They're less likely to be diagnosed for depression by their doctor. It's can be very shameful, and a lot of people are very much against like Western medicine's approach to depression, and there are a number of other ways to deal with depression as well. But identifying depression and suicidal thoughts and negative thoughts that are leading, because when someone's depressed, then they have a lot of negative feelings. They feel very ashamed about themselves. Humiliation is a big problem for men. And I believe the depression is the thing that really, that and the pattern of power and control and a belief system that is very patriarchal, that male privilege, that I should have power over you. You are my possession because I am the man. Men run our country, men run the world, and I should have more control in this relationship. And so when they become dangerous is when they start losing power over that person. So like when the woman tries to leave, he feels very powerless. It'll come out looking like anger and violence, but it's really about a sense of powerlessness, helplessness, hopelessness, and not getting his help for himself is an issue along those lines too. So did I answer the question?
No, I think you did.
I think, yes. Jeff always asks multi-layered questions, but okay. Which is good. We appreciate that. And before we go back to the next caller, one of the interesting things I'm wondering in terms of addressing this is working with people with this is there's, clearly this seamless to me between the personal and the social issue. And how do you work that in? Because, oftentimes people, the language will be about powerlessness, and it seems to be just, people are encouraged to view this on an individual basis as opposed to saying, yeah, well, okay, I need to address that issue. But I also, it's going to be hard to do if we don't address the broader social fabric in which it's happening.
Absolutely. I mean, we have huge sociocultural support for domestic violence.
Right.
And the patriarchal culture has a huge part to play in that, the hugest part to play in that. And we've got to change the way that women are and children are treated in this country. They're treated as second-class citizens. They're objectified. They're reduced to possessions. And I don't think it's something that a lot of people are consciously doing, but when the culture is saturated with this idea that men are in charge, that a woman is supposed to, be equal to a certain point, and then he has more power in the relationship, then we're just going to perpetuate the cycle, along with the cycle of violence. When children are raised in violent homes, they learn how to be abusive by watching it, and they learn that violence is acceptable in love.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We have more callers waiting to get on the air. And if you want to join us, give us a call at 503-231-8187. We're talking this morning with Jennifer Warren of the Men's Resource Center and Women's Counseling Center about domestic violence. Good morning, Frances. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
This is odd. There's no black and white in human relationships. There's matters of love, trust, betrayal, loyalty, who knows how one individual will respond to any of those. But I would like to reiterate, I've witnessed relationships where the woman is the one who is psychologically, emotionally abusing and putting down constantly. And so although I know that most of those kind of relationships that are reported are perpetrated by the man, I would just like to, since we're just talking men, women right now, reiterate that oftentimes the women are the psychological abusers. Also, there are men I've known who were in it for the long haul, as one man said, till, false teeth and everything. And then some other man turned the wife's head, and she decided to leave with the children. And this literally turned the man's life upside down. Now, I think that a couple of these murder-suicides were those sorts of situations. There wasn't necessarily abuse leading up to the murder-suicide. And when there is a divorce in this patriarchal society, the man, although he may not be able to see his children for weeks at a time, is expected to provide support for them and sometimes literally maintain two households. I just want to remind people that there are a lot of very heavy expectations placed on men who have the same emotional, psychological makeup as women, but they're supposed to handle it differently.
Okay.
Keep that in mind, please.
Well, thank you, Frances. I guess, would you have a comment? If I'm reading Frances right, is saying that the same patriarchal system is placing pressures on those who are at least supposed to be in the privileged position, and it as well as taking a toll. Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, I think it is in some situations, but overall, then that's the stance that the majority of the clients have when they come into to our program. Mm. Is I'm the victim here. She did this. She did that. And so they're very heavily in what we call the victim stance, and it's very important that during group that we don't allow victim stancing. So it doesn't really matter how the relationship, let me rephrase that. It doesn't, what we try to focus on is you can only control yourself. You can't control someone else. So if you're a man and you are being psychologically abused by your partner, then, you do need to recognize that, you probably do have more options to get out of that relationship than a woman might have. But it doesn't make it okay to be abusive in return.
Right.
And so there are options other than responding with abuse. And the majority of men who have been arrested for domestic violence blame the victim. And so the victim blaming is a big part of this that we have to really pull out of the equation when we're working with these men in order for them to change. And the more that people tell them, the more they have lawyers that say, if you had called the police, then she would have been arrested. Or police officers that say, she seems crazy, I don't blame you. And I'm not saying that happens very often. I'm just saying that that is something that I've had clients report. When they have all of these people reinforcing around them that they're okay, they're not being abusive, such as parents, family, a lot of times the victim gets blamed primarily. And then it's like, poor him, he was so worn out, he had to beat her up. And the reality is an attacker chooses to attack. It's not something that anyone deserves.
So I'm curious, Jennifer, how do we, like, get at the front end of this? I mean, it's almost like, you know, do we need to raise our children differently so that there's a different kind of expectation at the back end? Are there ways to actually develop training so that men and women in their interaction? I mean, do we actually even teach people how to engage as young men and women as they're starting the dating process, right? Because what I hear is that, you know, that's really the time that a lot of violence takes place. And
absolutely,
there seems to be this expectation in the teen years that your boyfriend is going to slap you, and that translates to love.
Right.
So, I mean, how do we, like, get at the front end of this so that, I mean, do we start at, you know, at infancy and start this immersion program or what?
Well, to answer your question, I'd say yes to all of that. I think that if we're going to, we have to change our culture in order to change this problem and fully address it. We have to look at how are children being raised? Right. What are they being told in their homes? Right. What are they being told in school? What are they being told by the media? You know, what does our culture value? And our culture values masculinity quite a bit. And the things that go with masculinity, the ideals of power and so forth, actually, you know, although it gives men privilege, it also takes away their ability to empathize with the feelings of others, their ability to really connect and be interconnected. And so we need to change our culture and how we raise our boys and our girls. And I tell men and women when they first come in for an intake with me and they're upset, it's like, you know, you may come in kind of kicking and screaming the first few groups, but after a while you'll get to like it. Mm-hmm. And many men have never had the opportunity to sit and talk with other men about feelings, mm-hmm, or even, you know, explore their feeling word vocabulary.
Right.
And so we have to change, you know, the way that boys are raised, not telling them big boys don't cry, and trying to get them to stuff their feelings down. We also need to change our culture and recognize that women and girls are objectified, sexualized. You know, just looking at commercials, you know, when you're in this group, you stop looking at the world the same way afterwards. Mm. Commercials start to really anger a person after they recognize that sexism is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something else that has to change. But also, we all have to join together and be working together for social justice. So just because you don't personally think that you've been impacted by domestic violence, mm-hmm, knowing about it, understanding it, if you're driving along the street and you see someone hitting another person at a bus stop, call the police. Mm-hmm. And I want to emphasize, I do believe calling the police is the first choice, even though I know some people wouldn't make that choice. It is the safest choice for most people. But I think we all need to be involved, and we all need to be allies to each other and recognize that it's not an isolated incident. It's something that we all need to change.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines because time's running short and calls are piling up. And let's go to our next caller. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Hello, is that me?
That's you.
Wow, what a can of worms. This just brings up a whole bunch of stuff, and the first one here is probably not going to make me very popular, but I have to say, you know, much as I love my redoubtable comrade Jeff, passing more of the same kind of gun laws we have and restricting law-abiding gun owners, which are the vast majority of them, is not going to make any difference in the situation. Having said that, I think we need to figure out a way to keep guns out of the hands of the emotionally disturbed and crazy. And I really don't have a way to do that right offhand. You know what I'm saying?
Well, let's see what our guest has to say about that. Hold on.
Well, people that are emotionally disturbed can do a pretty good job of fitting in with everyone else. So there's it's not like people walk around with a V on their forehead saying, I'm someone who has potential for violence. And access to guns is what has been going on lately around here. I mean, these have been gun shootings. And so I do think that accessibility of firearms is something that is, and it's also something that the police look for as far as lethality goes in a
sure.
Well, I think my point here is that the guns are already out there, okay?
Yeah.
There's
mm-hmm.
something like 500 billion firearms in the United States at this point, way more than one for every man, woman, and child.
Right.
How we keep that out of people's hands. I mean, if you read the statements of career criminal, violent criminals who've shot at the police when asked if gun laws ever stop them in any way at all, they laugh and laugh and laugh. Of course not. You know, how did the guy that did those four cops up in Washington last week ever get his hands on a gun?
Well, we're
illegally.
I think we're really on an issue here that deserves a whole show of its own, because it is really kind of a different topic. And we're all running out of time, so I'm going to move on. I want to thank you for doing that, and we will do a show about the gun issue where we can give it the attention it deserves. Okay.
One quick comment on the main portion of this.
Sure.
We've come a long way since, say, the 1950s. I've been reading Joan Haverty Kerouac's memoir of her life with Jack Kerouac, and at the point where she decided she was going to leave the bum and just wanted her own little apartment, the law wouldn't allow it.
Thank you.
The movers would not move her into the apartment because her husband was there saying no.
Yeah, yeah. No. I agree. Progress has been made, but we got a long ways to go. So,
thank you.
We'll talk to you another time here.
Yes.
Let's quickly go back to the phone line. Beth, you're on the phone, and you're going to have to keep it short because we're running low on time.
I retired. I worked 25 years in the specific social service that you're talking about today. So I do know a lot about what the women go through. I worked for Washington County Community Action and then Tualatin Valley Mental Health in the exact same capacity, and that was working with women and children and in the homeless shelter, women with significant others. And I preferred the women just than the children at the other rehab. Anyway, just to make a long story short, there's very strong economic pressures on men to keep their families together, to keep their heads together. And they drink. They'll have some drugs in the house. They'll get, you know, out of it. They'll beat up their wife. She calls the police to protect herself and the children. DHS comes. They take the kids away. She's mandated by the court to go through a rehab, our rehab, which was a 10-month rehab, and it was a lockup before she could get her children back. It's endless. This subject is huge. It has to do with so many issues of economic pressure on men to find jobs, to be able to support their kids, and not to have it bring them down so much that they go to drinking and drugging. But once the women lose their kids, they have to go through rehab to get them back.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry, ma'am. Excuse me, ma'am. Thank you so much for your call, and you're right. There's a lot more. We've just started peeling this onion, and there's a whole lot more that we could certainly talk about. And unfortunately, we're ending on that note, which is really about, and we talked about that, some of the implications of actually having, calling the police, right? It's just not about the police coming and keeping you safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really think that the last caller raised a good point. It's like you have to actually know what the repercussions are going to be once you call the police.
Absolutely.
And then the caller raised another point, which is then all of a sudden you're in a position of having to fight to get your kids back.
Right.
And so it's like you've called for one issue, and all of a sudden now you're in the system.
Absolutely.
And the system requires a lot before the problem is resolved. And so I think sometimes calling the police is probably a good thing, but I also think that there are all these unintended consequences that could be raised once you make that call.
I've heard a lot of women say that they felt re-victimized by the system after,
right.
you know, and that if they had the choice, they would not have approached it that way.
Mm-hmm.
However, sometimes that's exactly what they need in order to have the strength to get out of the relationship.
Right. Well, I can tell you, as someone who was a former victim of domestic violence and a former military person at the time, telling the authorities was the worst possible thing that could happen, right? Because what happened was my husband ended up going to jail. They took money from our household.
Uh-huh.
And then guess what? They sent them back home to me.
Right.
Right? And so it was the most stupid, idiotic thing. And so, of course, that was some years ago, and laws have changed and there are new processes in place. But, you know, it's a cautionary tale when you tell folks to call the police, because that doesn't always work to your benefit.
Well, and of course, once again, we're reaching a critical point to talk about when we only have about a minute or so left. But it really addresses the issue that we need to be moving beyond law enforcement and looking at creating a whole different infrastructure out to address these issues. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but we want to make sure people are aware of, you know, what resources are out there, including the organization you work with. So are there any contact is there any contact information you can give out? Or?
Yes, I work at Men's Resource Center and Women's Counseling Center. Our phone number is 503-235-3433. And we have a website, and I believe there's a link on the KBOO site.
We have indeed put it on there.
And we never got to talk about the Women's Strength Program that you're involved in, so we'll just have to bring you back another time, Jennifer. And
gladly.
Get into that, and that, because, you know, the good news is that there are actually resources out there to help women with their emotional and physical ability to protect themselves. So.
And girls in the prevention.
And, girls.
And we're now going into schools and teaching girls how to recognize domestic violence before it happens to them.
Wonderful.
Well, I certainly hope that you will come back and we can continue this conversation. And there's so much more to explore on it and to hopefully educate our listeners about. We want to thank you for coming in this morning and for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
Well, I'm Dave Mazza.
And I'm Joanne Bowman.
And you've been listening to Voices from the Edge.
We'll see you next week. Same time, same place, same channel.
You have a good day now.
Get up.